slutty business.
Welcome to This Bloody Business. I'm your host, indie filmmaker Andrew Johnson Schmidt. Each episode, we talk to the creative people behind the movies that make us scream in terror and delight. From the best boy to the final girl, these are the people who bring our nightmares to life. On tonight's episode, we're talking to Elle Lamont, an actor out of Austin, Texas, with over 45 screen credits to her name. You might know her from the TV series From Dusk Till Dawn, or movies like Machete Kills, Alita Battle Angel, or Mercy Black, a Blumhouse picture that spent several weeks at the top of the Netflix charts. So let's find out how she did it, and what it's like to be a steady working actor on the indie movie scene. Here's my conversation with Elle Lamont.
Glad to have you on the show, an actor of many, many films. Running down your IMDb, I started to get a little cramp in my thumb.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. Now, how did you get into this creative game? What led you into independent film and all that?
Well, I definitely wasn't headed that direction at first. I was a smart kid. So I was like the gifted and talented program, advanced placement, college classes in high school, graduating year early kind of thing. I was going to go to school for behavioral analysis. Essentially, if you've seen the show Criminal Minds, I was going to be one of those people. I had gotten into modeling back in like junior high and high school and was doing that, but you know, that wasn't like a serious career type of thing. So I'm on the school path and I sort of got talked into doing the Miss Texas USA preliminary pageants. Miss Lake Whitney was the one that contacted me. So I ended up in that. And by way of winning Miss Lake Whitney, a film that was being made on the lake and on the Brazos River contacted me, contacted the pageant coordinator to see if I would want to be in their movie. It was a water sports docudrama about all these professional water sports athletes and kind of how they spend their summer and training and hanging out and stuff. So I did it and then realized that I really missed the small amount of acting that I had done before in school. So I switched majors and went to school for acting. Did a couple short films and a couple student films right out of the gate and while I was still in college. And then booked a role as Miss UV Alcoholic Rally Girl on Friday Night Lights, the TV series. And from there, I mean, I worked on that show 5 days a week for a season and a half. So then I was just, that's where I was and I was in. Since then I've taken more acting classes and done more workshops and various things like that to kind of stay involved and whatnot. I love it. It's a good place to be when you're on set, in the trenches, working with everybody and trying to make this huge machine go, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And you're part of that new generation of actors who, we think of people who are teleworking, if you will, living someplace other than LA, or working LA productions and the other satellites, Atlanta, Louisiana, that kind of thing. Writers at first could do that remote and get away with it, aside from, you know, people in writers' rooms. Now we're seeing some actors that are doing it. How much did you balance that in your head before you decided, no, I'm going to live in Texas for now?
I've just kind of taken every year as it comes. I'm a bit nomadic, even though I've been here in this city for so long. So I'm always somewhere else, usually spending maybe 3 months out of the year here in Austin. And the rest of the time I'm either traveling for work or traveling for pleasure. It just seemed to fit with what I wanted at the time. And then it continued to work. So I didn't ever have to leave. That adaptability, I think, is just part of, it kind of comes with being an actor and being able to, you know, embody so many different characters. You know, like sometimes I'll go on like 5 auditions a day or something. So I'm playing all of these different people at once. That kind of adaptability just helps with that sort of thing. Same with the pandemic and everything switching over to, you know, taped auditions, Zoom callbacks and things like that. Some people kind of struggled with it at first, but I think the fact that we're all already kind of into that whole, like, all right, this is what we need to do, so let's figure out how to do it mode anyway, that it was just an easy transition.
Where do you fall on the subject of taped auditions versus in the room? Which do you prefer?
I really love a live audition. I think that those are a thing of the past now, which is really sad, but I like to feel the room. You know, I can kind of take the vibe from, usually there's a producer there and the director and a casting director. And so you've got these people to kind of work off of. You get a redirect in. I love a redirect, especially if it's totally different from what I've given first. And you don't get that opportunity on taped auditions so much. I mean, every now and then you can send off like a couple different versions of whatever, but it's not really the same. You're really just kind of like, here it is. Let's
like my day.
Let's hope it works. Yeah. And so I don't know. I mean, I guess there's benefits to both, because if you're taped, you know, you have that ability to be like, oh crap, that really didn't convey what I was trying to. I'm just going to do another take. And you don't always get that opportunity, but I kind of like that better. I like the fact that it's like, here it is, give it all you've got, see if you've got any notes, go from there. It's more of a working environment then versus just a, you know, here I am world kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, with your characterizations, I was going down the list of your movies that, you know, I could readily put my hands on. And I am just fascinated because you've played serious badasses. Also played people who are like humans that are in a scary situation, or it is so interesting to see, you know, flipping back and forth between the two, like Mercy Black, which is up right now, and Mercy Black's on Netflix.
Yes.
Yeah, was one of the featured films.
It was actually number one on Netflix last year. So that was really great.
How random is that?
Right.
Strange. Like, it's like having an Oscar. It's like, where do I put this? I'm very strange. So Mercy Black, you play this like really, a person the audience can really empathize with, you know, mm-hmm. you're stuck in this like haunted situation. Trying to take care of your family, but then, you know, in Alita Battle Angel, not as much along those lines.
Not as much of a caring down to earth sort of character, screwhead. Yeah. Well, and there's a story behind this too. So while I was in school for acting and film, the dean of the department and my advisor, because he was one and the same, told me that I was very attractive and I was very sensual. So I should use my sensuality to get whatever roles I could. And that was the way I was going to make it in this industry.
Okay. Can I just pause here? In this moment, was that in person, that conversation, or was that on the phone?
Oh, that was in person.
Just how hard did you grab the chair? Like, the arms of the chair. Were you like making a cracking sound with your knuckles?
I have a really well-developed jawline because of the things that people have said like that. I just clench and don't speak, I think. Another very... very important person within the theater program that I was going to also said that I would only ever be an ingenue. And so I needed to just be okay with that and just accept it.
Like, and you're a jockey, you've got 2 good years and then you're out to pasture.
Right. Right. You're always going to be the damsel in distress and somebody's always going to need to save you, babe. Just deal with it, you know? And I didn't want that. That sounded very boring to me. That sounded very one-dimensional and it's the same character that we've seen over and over again. So for the first 4 years of my acting career, I only took roles where I killed people and I killed a lot of people. So then that kind of cemented me in the action and horror genres as like a believable person, you know, like a person that you would want to cast for those roles. And then I kind of took the softer roles here and there just to make sure that I could still be more of a human character.
But that says something though, that you were able to transition. Cause as you say, producers have a tendency to go, okay, I need a killer lady who's been killing lately. Okay, we'll get one of those. They're not noted for their like, yeah, I saw her in the cherry orchard, but I think she can kill.
Right. But the good actors can, and that's what any actor is wanting to strive to be. I mean, you know, it's that thing like you'll watch a movie, you can watch a movie from start to finish and only realize Gary Oldman was in it at the very end of the film because he's just that good.
Yeah.
So it was that kind of thing. Like I didn't want to model my career after. I mean, there are some amazing female actors that were superstars whenever I was just starting out and I admire them and respect them, but I wanted something a little different. I wanted a little more Steve McQueen and Gary Oldman in my repertoire, you know?
Yeah.
And
you're in a time period where that's an option.
Right.
So take advantage of that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've even had roles that were written for male characters rewritten for me, which has been really cool because, I mean, there were minimal changes made. It wasn't like they had to give me a baby and a husband or something because now I'm a girl. I think being careful about what you take helps with that. Like once I was on a roll with the whole action film thing, I didn't just go for action films all of the time. And you know, there were a couple times that I've been told in the casting room that I wasn't quite vulnerable enough to play certain characters or whatever during that time period. So there was a little bit of that, like, nah, we've seen what you do. You just want to kill people, and this isn't one of those. but then every now and then somebody's just like, well, let's just see what you have. Let's just see it. And you're able to do that and kind of change their minds, I guess.
But you know, that was interesting. Going back to the character you played in Mercy Black. Okay, she's a working gal. She had this badassery there. And you know, yes, your jaw. But I mean, like she had this, like, she's the one, like, you know, if there's going to be like a car wreck, she's the one who's going to get out of her car and start pulling people out. But she's not killing people. She's working a regular McLife.
I think that I worked really well for that character. Like me as an actor worked really well for that character because, you know, when she's very young, she's the younger sister of the two sisters. And when she's very young, all this crazy stuff that she doesn't really understand happens to her sister, and her sister goes away and is just gone. So she kind of grows up dealing with all of the fallout from that because it's a small town. Everyone knows that her sister went crazy and all of this stuff happened. You know, a girl was killed and they don't really know whether or not she, you know, like, you know how small towns go. Everyone knows that. So the fact that she had to deal with that early on and then coming through that to the death of her parents and then having a child and then being a single mother, that it was just one of those things where it's like she's already dealt with a whole lot of shit. So, I mean, you just spring into action and do whatever you can. Someone pointed out to me the other day that I don't take a lot of like motherly roles, but in that one, I was not only mothering a child, but also my sister when she comes back.
Yeah.
It was really interesting. That one was also a very hard film to do because a week into production, my grandfather passed away And I was raised by my grandparents alongside my dad because my parents were both very young when I was born. So it was like losing a father figure. I mean, I was losing a father figure. And I found out at RAP one night, and I called production, let them know what was going on. They were able to reschedule the entire shoot the next day so that they could get me out by, I think I was out by like noon or maybe 2 PM or something. And then, I was able to go home and be with my family and all of that. But then I was right back on set the following Monday. And you know, as you've said, there's a lot of stuff that happens in Mercy Black. It's kind of a heavier type thing. And so there's all this stuff that the character's going through, and there's all this stuff that I'm going through for real at the same time. But the whole crew was just amazing dealing with it. Letting me be off on my own away from everybody for the first few days after that. And then just coming in right when it was time to shooting and then getting back to my little space. They were really, really great. And it made everything work a lot better that I got the support from them to not have to put on a face behind the scenes as well as the face you're putting on for camera. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I have to ask, and tell me to shut up if you don't want to talk about it. How did that has to have affected your approach at that point, having gone through and considering the heaviness of the material that you're acting?
Right. Fortunately, I am not a method actor. They kind of creep me out. I know a lot of really talented ones, but I play a lot of heavy, darker characters, troubled characters, things like that. So if I were to stay in that headspace throughout a whole project, I feel like I would lose a part of myself in the end. Yeah. So I'm already able to make that division between the work and what's happening, to where I can be like bawling and crying, tears and snot flying everywhere. And then as soon as we cut, I'm like, all right, somebody give me a cigarette. Like, you know, we're good. That's been what's kept me from going insane playing all these crazy people. But in that particular instance, I just, the first scene at the top of the day after I found out, when they're trying to rush me through, was a huge kind of blow up argument between Daniela's character and my character. And it's an emotional scene anyway. And, but not in that way, you know, it's the same way that, like, as an actor, you're taught, like, don't think of sad things in your real life when you need to be sad on camera, because like your dog dying and your character's, child being kidnapped are two totally different emotions, and they're based differently, rooted differently within you. So there are some people that are able to do that, but it doesn't really work out in the end, because you end up being desensitized to the stuff that is real, that you need to stay connected to. And this scene was more of a, you know, she abandoned me by going through all of this craziness, and now she's back, and she's kind of bringing my son into all of this crazy, like, supernatural, whatever it is. And, so it was a totally different kind of thing. And I was really worried about how that was going to go. And, by the end of this scene, we got a standing ovation from the entire cast and crew that was out there watching the scene take place. And it just kind of gave me that extra little, I've never had that happen on a set before. I've never seen that happen on a set before. And it kind of gave me that little bit of extra, like, okay, I am going to be able to do this. These people are here for me. They understand and get it. We're going to get through this. But I do feel like it made her, the character, a little more, tender. You know, when Marina first comes home from this place that she's been this whole time and I haven't seen her, my character has this very kind of like nervous energy, very like, oh, I've got to take care of everything. What do you want for dinner? Blah, 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 this and that. And then there was like more of a softening that happened there, more of a like, I need to protect you kind of thing that already needed to be there. And I think it was strengthened by the fact that I was going through this other stuff and I was receiving good support. And I wanted to have done that kind of supportive sister figure thing for her anyway. And it sort of seamlessly transitioned, which would have been a lot harder if I was doing a comedy at the time or something, you know? Yeah. So I think it was okay. And I think, you know, there were probably a few times that I just leaned into everything that was going on and that showed a little bit. But with the complexity of my character, it was okay.
Yeah.
Question mark.
Yeah. We'll see. I thought the bonding between the sisters was really well handled. I remember at the dinner table, the two of you are both on one side of the table and the guy who's like, what is he, like a boyfriend? He's a friend.
He's sort of my jackass boyfriend, ex-boyfriend. And we break up over the course of the film. But yeah, he's just kind of this local dude that I've been seeing, but there's not like, it's not like a solid relationship, you know, right. Like he's clearly there to learn about her and to try to make some sort of money off of her story. So, and then I sense that she's just uncomfortable with everything at the time. So I don't think that she sensed that at all, but yeah, Austin Emilio is great. I had known him for a while at that point, so it was really good to finally get to work with him on something.
Well, it was great because there he was on the right side of the table as the camera looks and the two sisters on the other side. And you had your faces like right next to each other, you know, the way that like when siblings are just like, oh, I haven't seen you in so long. You just kind of just like, like, I remember looking at that and going, and we're not very far into the film at that point.
Right.
I buy this relationship. I buy this. And as you know, in a horror movie, whether it's supernatural or whatever, if you can get the buy-in on the humans, if you can get like the, I care about these people, I want good things for them, and then you put them up in a tree and start throwing rocks at them, like, that is an entirely different kind of horror movie. That's one where the audience is really invested, as opposed to chick runs around with a guy chasing her.
Right. Or, you know, a bunch of teens or college kids in the woods in the cabin or whatever. Yeah. That was easy because Daniela is amazing. I mean, I like, no bullshit, she's awesome. We met the day before production started.
Oh, wow.
We were both there for hair tests and to go through wardrobe fittings and things like that. And we met there very briefly. And just kind of talked through a few things with Owen Edgerton, the director, who's also really, really cool. And then we just hit it off. Like, she's very warm. She's very real. And she's weird. You know, I mean, if you've ever checked out like her Instagram or anything like that, you get a good impression of her real personality on there. She's fun to be around. And we spent a lot of time together. I mean, we were, because of how the scenes are laid out in this story, we were there every day together all day long. But yeah, she's a lot of fun. She had just finished Jurassic World at the time. And so she would go around every morning when we're all getting into hair and makeup, humming the Jurassic Park theme song while she's like filming all of the BTS that's going on. And every time that I would walk in, she would be like, sister, from that show from like 100 years ago, you know. So we just had a lot of fun off camera, and that made it easier to play up all of the things that were going on camera.
Yeah. Very cool. Very cool.
Yeah.
All right. So I got to say, I mean, you've got plenty of movies we could talk about. We could talk about Machete Kills. We could talk about From Dusk Till Dawn, the series, you know, Dead Still, The Next Kill, Flashes, if people have a Geiger counter and can find it, it's on TV right now, folks. And plenty of these films, but like Mercy Black, man, I just really felt like watershed. Do you feel like it was watershed for you, or is there something?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think, you know, up until that point, I had some good meat in some indie films. And then some supporting roles that were really cool and fun in larger productions. But, I hadn't really had that blend of the two yet. And, you know, Mercy Black was a Blumhouse film. And, you know, having to carry a lot of the plot of the film, and kind of cementing it in like the normal, ordinary, day-to-day reality type thing when you've got these crazy supernatural things going on too. I really liked the character a lot, and I liked the script. Every one of the actors was super talented. I mean, you know, like I've already said, like Austin, Daniela, Lee Eddy is amazing in it. She plays the librarian. And you know, Miles is great, the little boy who plays my son, super creepy. He's not creepy in real life, but he came off so well. It all just worked really well, and Owen gave us the freedom to kind of bring what we wanted to the table. And then, you know, he would of course adjust if necessary, but we got that kind of creative collaboration thing that doesn't happen a lot on bigger shows, because you've got time constraints, you know, you've got character lines already running and things like that. Another really cool thing about that one that just made it really comfortable to be there, that film had the most female department heads I have ever seen on any project in my entire career.
Really?
Almost every department had a female department head, with the exception of maybe three.
Wow.
And that was just something I had never seen before, and it wasn't intentionally done. And the director actually realized it a week or two into filming and was just like, whoa, this is pretty cool. I was able to come away from it, even before seeing any of the film, being proud of what I had done. Which is hard for an actor, because usually you're sitting there rethinking every decision you made and coming up with way better solutions for anything that you did. So there's usually a lot of second guessing after the fact. And this time I walked away and I was just like, no, I feel really good about this. And then when it came out, I mean, Ellie is such a great DP and Owen is such a great director. The film, it worked really well. And all of the things that I liked about the character originally actually, you know, came through. You know, it was, like I said, it was a Blumhouse film. It was number one on Netflix. They kind of teased.
When you were in production phase, was there anything different because it was a Blumhouse film, or was that not anything that you felt prior to it, you know, coming out?
We had some reps there, but I mean, that's not unusual. You know, I did a sci-fi film. We had sci-fi reps on set for that. So that wasn't too big of a deal. They kind of, at least from my end, because I don't see a lot of the conversations that happen offset and away in production meetings and things, but it seemed like they kind of just let the film be made and didn't try to put too much control over it. they didn't have a heavy presence there. They might just come in and watch a few scenes for the day. And then so I say something quick that they needed to say to whoever, and then they're gone.
That's what you like.
The coolest part about it being a Blumhouse film was the way that they promoted it afterwards. Because when we were about to drop the film, Blumhouse tweeted something to Netflix, kind of teasing them with like, hey, I've got something scary for you tonight or whatever. And Netflix teased back with like, what do you have? You know, like, let's see it, whatever. And they kind of played this game out until the release on Netflix. And then it got such great traction from that, that they had a theatrical run for it that wasn't originally planned. It was supposed to just be a streaming film. And then it went back to Netflix, and that's when it really gained steam and became a number one film. So I think they just had that kind of clever, current, modern knowledge of how people want to interact with their media. And like, that was one of the coolest parts of having them on board for it.
So let's talk about that building the character. I'm going to just go out on a limb here. Tell me if I'm wrong, but it seems like in the two models that we talk about, like the English model with the outside in defining the character, you find the hat and then you go inside and find the character that's wearing that hat. Mm-hmm. The American model, mm-hmm. go from inside out and eventually you get a hat based on who you are. Where do you put yourself in that?
I don't think I fit either one. I'm familiar with both, and I've worked with people from both sides, but I like to look at the psychology of the character as though it is a real person that I am reading about and looking into and learn about them. So I don't create any sort of backstories that aren't there or anything like that. I don't really have anything like that. What I do is I start to build a playlist as I'm going over this character and trying to kind of feel out, you know, where they're coming from, what their problems are, what the obstacles are, and things like that. As I'm doing that, I'm building a playlist that kind of works with the full arc of the character. And then I listen to that as I'm preparing for each individual scene as well.
Wow.
So I kind of like, I look at each character as though they are real, tangible characters that I am having to learn everything about. And then I just put that on, I guess. I don't really build it. I just feel like I more or less investigate who these people are first.
Yeah.
Which kind of goes back to what I was originally going to do in the real world before I decided to become an actor. And I think that helps a lot with my methodology, the fact that I do have that experience with psychology and criminal psychology, since I don't play the nicest characters all the time. But yeah, so that's the way that I do it. I'm sure there's other people that do, but who knows?
So where the rubber meets the road, when you're working with your directors, you don't have to name names. But what kind of interaction have you had with directors in terms of shaping that character, either in the run-up to shoot day or on shoot day? How are they helping you do it generally?
Some directors will just if they need a good relationship to come off on camera between two actors, they'll just be like, you guys need to meet, go hang out. Like, that's kind of what happened with myself and Daniela on Mercy Black. You know, just go hang out while we finish this up and get ready for your wardrobe fittings, you know? And then I've known directors that will separate people that aren't supposed to have an on-screen connection so that you never even get to know the person until the end. But I feel like that's cheating to do those kinds of things. Because it's the same thing that I have with method actors. To me, And no offense to all the method actors out there in the world, please don't attack me for that. But like, if I'm having to live a character for 6 weeks, 6 months, whatever, in order to be that character on screen, it's not really acting. You're literally becoming that character. And I like to keep those things separated. You know, like I like to have the difference there. It's part of the exciting part of acting for me, is that it is a totally different world. And then I can just step right out of it whenever I want, step right back in. I tend to love it when I'm working with a director who gives me the creative freedom to do what I want, but also is completely decisive in what they want, so that if they're not getting what they want, you know, and you're able to like discuss that and get it. But if they're loving it, you get that affirmation. They're like, all right, we're good, moving on. And I think that those come off best on camera, because then you're able to see, like, there's a reason why a director casts an actor in a role.
Sure.
And so letting them do that and then just reining them in or pushing them more if they need it, I think delivers a much better and easier project than if you're having to constantly, you know, dial in for the person and be super hands-on as a director. So I don't like it when they're totally like stand off, do your thing, but I also don't really dig the full control freak aspects of some directors. So I like the happy medium there.
Yeah.
Robert Rodriguez is pretty good about that too. He'll come in, he'll greet everyone for the day, all the actors that are going to be working. Run a rehearsal. If he has any notes, he'll be called over. He's not one of those directors that like shouts the notes from his director's chair behind Video Village or whatever. He calls you over, discusses whatever. And it's never like definitive, say it like this, do it like this. It's just more like, all right, so you just came from blah, 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 and this is what you're thinking. So like, let's just see that, you know? And that gives you the grounding and the freedom at the same time, which is really cool.
The combination. Yeah.
Yeah.
So going back to Mercy Black, it's a scary movie, supernatural horror. When you're on set, as we all know, you know, set, it can have its own scares, but not in the way that a horror movie is. when you finally did see it with other people, what was that like? And I mean, you got the music, you got the Foley, everything's in there. What was that like to see yourself in that horrific situation?
It was really cool. It was, well, and I say that because I jump in scary movies, all of them, whether they're actually scary or not, and all of the time throughout the movie. So, but not usually with my own, because I know everything that's going to happen. And with that one, I was able to like get the jump scares from myself, you know, like I was able to get into watching the movie instead of watching what I had done or knowing what was happening next or thinking about filming that scene from, you know, a year ago or whatever. So it was really cool to watch it as an audience member. Kind of thing. Like I was able to get into it. That house was creepy. Just going back to what you're talking about how like, you know, scary movies and things. The house was one of those like Sears Roebuck catalog houses from back in the day. It was used for one of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre movies. Way out in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of a huge field. There was the room that is Marina's room, my sister's room in the film, had a latch lock on the outside, which was creepy. And it wasn't part of the film. It was just there, you know, when we got to location. And it had its own bathroom attached to it, like built in and everything. So it was just a very creepy place to be
Was the bathtub in the same building, or was that a separate building?
The bathtub that she's in the bathtub scene was in the house, but a different bathroom than the one that's in her room.
I mean, that's the classic horror trope, right? But that was really well handled. Like, I was like, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and that of course was a closed set day for that scene. And so I didn't know what to expect for like the visuals of how that was going to come off until I was in the theater watching it. And that was done really well. I believe that was the director's kid that is the creepy hands in the film too. Yeah, that house definitely lent to the vibe of the characters and whatnot. And it's a great house, beautiful old house, but it just had some weird elements to it. It was right next to a field of donkeys. So in the evenings, they would all line up along the fence and start braying. And so then we're holding for donkey, which is something I had never done before in my life.
That's awesome.
That was a whole new hold. but it was cool. And it was far removed from everything. I mean, I think the closest gas station was like 20 minutes away. And then there was nothing for an additional 20 minutes. So once you're there, you're just in that world. And that was definitely fun. When I was working on Dead Still, we shot a lot of that film at the 13th Gate, which is a haunted house in Louisiana. And like a professional haunted house. And that was the same kind of vibe as that, you know, like there's already that element of creepiness there that just kind of helps you feel and get into it. Yeah, watching it with everyone was really cool, especially, I mean, we got to do the premiere of the film in Austin, which doesn't always happen. It rarely happens. So you of course have all the cast and crew there, and that's great to kind of relive everything with them while you're watching it. But also, it wasn't just that you were getting to see how an audience reacts to it. You're getting to see how like your people that you're interacting with and immersed with every day, like the people that live in the city that I'm in, were receiving it and how they were interacting and reacting to things that were happening. So that was it. That was a neat little kind of different moment there.
Yeah. So going forward, of course, there's the hiccup that is 2020.
Is that what we call it?
Hiccup as in like you swallow something wrong and you're on the floor trying to breathe.
That guy.
How many projects would you say at this point you've got sitting around trying to get themselves going again?
I had, at the end of 2019, I had 7 films slated for 2020 and a Comic-Con appearance. The appearance, of course, is canceled completely. But as far as the films go, they're all postponed. There are 4 more that I have been sent over the last like 6 months or so, that are also now in the queue to be worked on. But, you know, it's just going to depend on first if you've got this huge time block and you want the investors to stay interested, but surely not all of them are going to. And then the logistics and the like safety procedures that are now have to be in place could be problematic for some, but maybe not for others. So I'm not really sure exactly which ones are going to happen at this point, but there's 11. And so hopefully some of them.
Yeah. It is a numbers game.
Yeah. And Salvage Marines and Playing God were both supposed to come out last year. And, you know, they've been put off for the pandemic to be released at a better time. So there is still stuff in the works that will come out while I have just been sitting around in lockdown and whatnot. And that's really great. But yeah, I'm ready. I'm ready to get back on set. It's been long enough.
Isn't it weird? Like when you do like a really intensive film, like a lot of overnights or whatever, you're just like, I just want to be home. And then when you're gone for too long, like I start jonesing on being on set. Like I just, I miss it sometimes.
I've been pretty lucky to have, for the most part, really great experiences on set. There's been a few, and I won't name them, but there's been a few crazy ones. But other than that, I enjoy it. Like you get tired at certain points, of course. You know, my shortest day on Alita was 16 hours. Most of them were 20 to 24. And then, you know, none of us are working the entire time, but it's not like you can go take a nap in your trailer or anything. Cause there's just so the process that happened with that film. But I don't ever not like it unless there's just an individual causing problem.
Sure.
Tearing down the morale or something. So even when I'm tired, I can rally just for the fact that I like my job a lot. Like I really like my job. So, yeah, I miss it.
We have gotten through to Andrew's five big questions. Now, no matter how you've spun these softball questions into answers, Andrew's five big questions are when it, answered right off the top of your head, will lay bare your soul and let the audience know, hey, do we come out for that next Al Lamont film or do we stay home for that Knight Rider marathon? No pressure.
Thanks for the the wording there. That's great.
Fair you. Question number one. What is your most treasured possession?
I have a 1966 Dodge Charger. That was my very first car. Mm. It was my dad's car when he was 16. And we pulled it out of the field and restored it together whenever I turned 15, because I wanted that to be my first car. So I still have it. I haven't driven it in years, but I'm actually going to be getting it running again soon. So I guess that's, as far as possessions go, like that one, I've got the like sentimental connection because of my dad and the fact that we worked on it together, and then to revive it again would be really cool. So maybe the Charger.
All right. Question number two, where in the world, and I'll give you what time period too, I'll throw that in, where and when would you most like to live right now? Anywhere in the world, any when in time?
I would love to be on an island in the Bocas del Toro archipelago of Panama right now. I was there in 2019. My husband and I eloped on a pirate ship there.
Question number three. Which movie character in all of cinema do you most identify with?
I don't know that I do.
Interesting.
Is that weird?
Well, let me ask you this. The characters you know most inside and out in cinema are the ones you've played yourself. Which character would you say you most identify with of those?
Oh, well, that might actually be even harder. You know, based solely off of personality of the character, probably my Salvage Marines character, which is going to sound crazy at first, but let me explain. She sees through the bullshit, like corporate tyrannical bullshit. She knows what the real value is, and that's real life, but everyone in the Salvage Marines world is born into debt already that they have to pay back. So there's all of this stuff going on that way that is preventing people from like living up to their potential and doing what they want to do and just living life and things. And she knows that, and she's only there to pay off her life debt. And then she's done, she's out of the Salvage Marines. But also she feels this like she's the squad boss. So she obviously feels this responsibility for all of these other people. And she knows that most of these people don't ever get to do what they should and live as long and as full lives as they should. And so she's trying to protect them and prepare them. And she, like, I'm hypercritical, but I'm most critical of myself. So, you know, it's a fair across the board, I guess. She's very empathetic, even though she's this Marine squad boss. She feels what's happening with all of her squad. So yeah, just going off of core personalities, I would probably identify with Boss Maggie Taggart the most. And that role did come really naturally. There wasn't a whole lot of like trying to get myself ready for certain scenes. I had a killer playlist for that one because it's all battle driven and whatnot, which helped a lot.
All right. Question number four, what word or phrase drives you nuts?
I have a lot of words that drive me nuts, or phrases, I guess.
But you get one chance to delete button.
One, if I had to pick one, it is what it is. I hate it. I hate it for so many different reasons. I mean, like, obviously it's a cliche and cliches are just, you know, but nothing is what it is. You know, it's a false statement, and it's kind of like a defeatist statement, because usually when people use it, it's when they've given up or they're telling you to about something, you know? So it's like, well, I'm sorry, it is what it is. And that one is the one that just kind of makes me want to just.
Mental phrases not to use around. All right.
I think we can always change stuff, you know. Sometimes we lack the motivation or the time or the money or whatever, but like there, you know, there's always room for something to change. So that's why it bugs me.
Gotcha. All right. First bonus question. If you were to come back after dying with just 24 more hours for you, what would you do?
I would visit people that I wanted to say bye to. And let them know that it's all good. Just keep doing you and living your life. I'm not super big on the whole. I'm not a super religious person, so I'm not into like afterlife and things like that. And a lot of the people I know aren't either, and so they tend to feel that when someone is gone, they are just gone. So that's more painful, I've noticed, than knowing that someone's in a better place or whatever, you know, whatever kind of thing that you might subscribe to. So I think I would just go to the people that I love the most and be like, hey, I'm dead, but it's all going to be all right. You know, like, I guess.
Yeah. All right. Second bonus question. What is the perfect breakfast?
Breakfast tacos, bacon, egg and cheese, breakfast tacos. People can bribe me to do a lot of things with breakfast tacos.
All right.
Yeah, I could probably live off of them. And I don't know what it is. There have been a few films, especially shooting outside of Texas, where you don't have breakfast tacos at Crafty in the morning. And those are a little sadder for me to participate in. Just because that's kind of, yeah, that's how I like to start my day on set, I guess.
Makes sense. All right. Question five. And longtime listeners know, bonus points on this one.
Uh-oh.
Ireland. Funny or not funny?
Both. Oh. I've been to Ireland twice. Lamont is an Irish name. It was Lamont before we immigrated, but the Irish weren't received so well at first, so it got Frenched up. But true story, it's so peaceful and serene and gorgeous and green. It really is as green as everyone thinks it is. So there's that, like, that's not funny. That's just beauty, right? But then, you know, you get stuck for 45 minutes in the middle of the road as all of the sheep are crossing the road. And they do that all the time. And that's kind of funny. There are more pubs than anything else. And that's hysterical to me. We ended up on stage with a local band called the Potbellied Folk. And we were playing instruments and singing along with them because they loved Texans. So definitely both. Both funny and not funny.
All right. Elate the presses in Ireland. Well, Elle, thank you so much for being on the show. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
It's been great talking to you too. Thanks for having me.
That was my interview with actor Elle Lamont. Subscribe to This Bloody Business and join me as we go behind the scenes for more tantalizing tales of horror filmmaking. Until next time, I'm Andrew Johnson Schmidt, and that's a wrap.